This is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where I always hasten to say the intelligence goes to my guests. In this case, no question, Neil Richards is one of the leading legal experts on the whole notion of privacy, what protection does it deserve, what regulations can be put in place. He's a law professor at Washington University, and he's written a book. You would think you don't even need such a book, Why Privacy Matters. Down through the history of human race, there's been a great concern about privacy. And you could go back in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, the Magna Carta. You can go to our own Fourth Amendment protection of privacy. Anyone who's lived in a more overtly totalitarian country knows about privacy. One of the glaring examples of why you want privacy is the effort of the FBI in our own country to destroy Martin Luther King, to drive him to suicide, which is discussed in Neil Richards' book. If you don't know about it, that's worth the price of admission right there. But the real issue is we've got this wild internet world now where people give up their privacy willingly, excitedly. Let me tell you where I shop and where I've gone and who I had lunch with, how far I read into this ebook, and the mechanism that exists now, where one of the big examples in this book is Target, as long ago as 2002, was finding out, could tell when a woman got pregnant. And when she got pregnant, when she was going to deliver, she didn't know. That's because she bought unscented products or so, different things like that, and then could market to that woman. So just why don't you set the stage of, okay, why privacy matters? And if it matters so much, why don't we protect it?
That's a great question. It's great to be with you talking about these really important ideas today. Privacy matters because information is power, and because human information confers power over human beings. That's why governments are keen to monitor our communications. It's why companies like Target are keen to find out when their customers are pregnant, so they can habituate them to becoming Target customers, too enfeebled by changing diapers and chasing after toddlers to change their habits. It's why those parents maybe go to Target and they shop for a baby monitor so that they can keep an eye on their little one and stop them from hurting themselves. It's why older parents use Find My Friends on Facebook. Privacy is about power. And it's about power over other people. And our information, if we care about our agency, if we care about our ability to figure out who we are, if we care about consumer protection or political freedom, we have to care about privacy. Notwithstanding a lot of the self-serving myths that I talk about in the book, from governments, security services, and corporations, particularly technology companies, advancing the myth that privacy is somehow dead or dying.
Well, the interesting thing is that argument, the Mark Zuckerberg, you know, argument, get used to it, get over it, and so forth, that's kind of fallen into disfavor recently because we have so many examples of the misuse of this information, and people are tired. They know we're not stupid. You know, you're reading something about, you know, maybe going to buy a car, and suddenly you're inundated with car ads or. And we know they know a lot about us. But what I think is so interesting is how this got out of control. We used to have an idea of regulation in the public interest. It's built into our Constitution, and even in terms of commerce and certainly fear of a surveillance state. We now have a surveillance economy, a famous book written about it. And the invasion of privacy is actually the main currency of the land. This information, you refer to it as the oil, the new oil that fuels the economy. And if you think about it, you look at our major corporations like Google and Facebook and so forth that people are so dependent on. And I find with my own students, you ask them the question, are you a customer of Google or Facebook? And they look at you, yeah, of course we are. Then why aren't you paying for it? You're not a customer. You're the mark. You're the sucker. And they got you in there and they're making money off you because they get your data. And then they go to their real customers, their advertisers, the people that they care about that are going to pay for all this, and you have targeted advertising. And all of this came about because we were infatuated with this new technology. You know, isn't that really what happened? And in order to play, to get in, they said, oh, give us all your information. We said, oh, yeah, yes, 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 because that will enhance maybe what is our main freedom, the freedom to shop, consumer sovereignty, right? And that's what people did willingly. And well, you can't understand the terms of service. You can't really make choices about it, because what are you going to do? Not use the internet? Not use Google? You know, you really don't have choices. And that's kind of the gist of your book, in a way. You surrender power to people who don't mean to do right by you.
Yeah, I mean, I think what happened was, and I'm old enough to remember this, I was a graduate student in the early 1990s. So in the 1980s, lots of deregulation. In the 1990s, you had new left governments in the United States and in Britain who were market friendly. And so you have this sort of market friendly environment, and the internet splashes onto the stage, 95, 96, 97. People began, if you remember the dot-com bubble, people remember being marveled by these technologies, but they also were a little concerned about data collection. And what we have today in, so 1997 or so, 1998, a regime of almost total surveillance of everything that you everywhere you go through Google Maps, everywhere you shop through the internet and credit card records, was both politically and technologically inconceivable. But what happened is there were movements towards regulation in the late 90s, and then unfortunately 9/11 happened, and the conversation around privacy shifted from digital technology and corporations to the war on terror. And so for about 10 years, privacy was thought at the national conversation level as primarily an issue of fighting crime and preventing another 9/11. At the same time, unfortunately, this tremendous processing revolution happened, and you get massive data collection. You get the rise of the ascendancy of Google and the founding and rise of Facebook, such that we looked around. We didn't have a conversation about regulating consumer privacy, and you look around, and about 2013, Edward Snowden's revelations happen, and we realize this is not the internet that we were promised. This is not the realm of human freedom and connection. This is a realm of misinformation and manipulation and data collection and abuse. And I think we are seeing, I think you're right, we are seeing today, encouragingly both from the left and from the right, an increased attention to the problems of information privacy. The Texas Attorney General recently filed suit against Facebook for its capture of biometric information. And we're seeing, you know, bills introduced in places like Massachusetts and Colorado and Virginia. So I'm hopeful, but there's still a lot of work to be done, and the law has to play an important role in building an internet that lives up to those promises from the early and mid-1990s.
Yeah, I'm not as hopeful, and the reason that's sort of outlined in your book, and by the way, the book is terrific in unmasking all of the rationalizations, all of the phony arguments for, you know, why it's sort of self-regulating. It's not. Yes, you have notice and choice, but what is the notice? You can't even understand half of these things. And what is your choice? You're going to drop Google? Well, Google was allowed to have this super monopoly. Where are you going to go? Facebook has this, you know, the cartels now, they're super monopolies. You don't have choice. And all of that was done in the name of innovation. You mentioned in Barack Obama's great legislation, supposedly, to preserve privacy, the word innovation was used 76 times, I think it was. And it's always this rationalization that science, progress, innovation requires surrendering rights that throughout most of human history, people guarded, certainly, their privacy. Their private being, their private space. Now they give up their dress size, their medical records. And you mentioned 9/11. It wasn't just 9/11. Thanks to Edward Snowden, who you give a lot of credit to in your book, and I think well-deserved, we learned something very critical. We always think that the only threat to our freedom is government. And, okay, if we do it with the private sector, that's our choice. You want to let them know what you're reading and how far you're reading. What Snowden revealed was that the information collected by the private sector will be grabbed by government, any government in the world, and grabbed by them if they have to cut into the cables, if they have to intimidate Google and Facebook, whatever they have to do, they get it. And so the line between the private sector and the government was obliterated. That's sort of the main contribution of Snowden, to show us that. And I think we should talk about that, because then what happens, since profit is so tied into getting this material, the pushback comes, oh, no, but if you don't do that, we can't take care of your medical information. We have to look at it. Oh, and then what happens? You have the pandemic now. And whatever momentum there was to protect privacy, I think, has been wiped out by this pandemic. And so now China, for example, which does a lot of surveillance, is kind of a model of effective control. Because they make you, you know, you carry around your iPhone or whatever it is, or Chinese version of it, and you have all of this data. And we turn over, I'm going to go teach tonight, and I've had to turn over an incredible amount of private information just to get on campus, you know, and to be monitored at every turn. So there's always some kind of necessity, some kind of danger, some kind of excuse. And they say, give us your privacy and we will make you safer. And isn't that where we are now again, once again?
Well, I think very often when you think about information collection, I'm reminded of Winston Churchill's great line, never let a good crisis go to waste. I think the problem that we have is that a lot of our modern technologies, and let me say, I am not a I'm not afraid of technology. I'm an immigrant to this country. My bribe that my parents offered when we moved was a computer in 1982. But a lot of the promises that we are required to make in order to participate in modern society is this acceptance of the collection of our data. And I think one of the things that I talk about in the book is that it's not just collection of data that we need to worry about. It's the uses that data is put to, and it's the rules that govern that information. So, for example, if data is collected in order to engage in reasonable contact tracing, use the pandemic example, or making sure that the campus environment is actually safe, that's one thing. When it is used to justify situations of social control, as we are definitely seeing, the reporting suggests in the Chinese case, that's the problem. Or if the information is just taken and used for an entirely different purpose, like marketing or other sorts of uses, that's as much of a question as the collection. And I think we need to ask, how is the information being used? What rules are governing the ways in which that information is being used? And whose values do they serve? Do they serve corporate values of making profit? Do they serve the values of government? Or do they serve the values of individual people to be politically free, to be full trusted economic participants in society, and to be able to figure out who we are in the privacy of our homes, but also in the privacy of our Zoom calls and digital connections with loved ones?
You know, I think I can answer your question on the basis of your book. The book answers the question why privacy matters, and makes a compelling case that you really can't have a decent, civilized, democratic society of free people if you don't have privacy.
Absolutely.
I think that's something the founders of this country said when they did the Fourth Amendment, and, you know, it was in response to the transgressions of the English crown. And but there are many examples throughout the world, and people who, you know the lash out there. And you know, when you think about it, what the FBI did to Martin Luther King, they had to follow him around physically. They had to get a hotel room next to him to try to entrap him, try to blackmail him. Now with modern technology, you know, you pointed out, I think it was in the case of the nomination of Bork to the Supreme Court, they could find out every movie he was watching. Turned out he wasn't watching pornography. But, you know, any candidate, anybody. And what I want to suggest is the book is worth reading because you should know why privacy matters. But it also doesn't really leave one with an optimistic view that we're going to be able to change this. And I just want to, you know, stress this. And the one reason why is that, and it isn't a left, right, Democratic or Republican. It is a view that somehow science in the hands of corporations will always be liberating. And where that really came, and your book describes it, you know, that use of the word innovation and so forth, it really did start in the 90s. And it wasn't just the explosion of the internet. It was also, it had come off Reagan's years of attacking government regulation, and Bill Clinton embraced it. I came away from this book angrier than ever with Bill Clinton because he gave away the store. And you actually had a very specific example with the banking deregulation, which we know where that led to the great housing meltdown. But I remember at that time, there was an interesting alliance of conservatives and liberals. You had Bill Sapphire, who had been Nixon's speechwriter, was then a columnist in the New York Times, attacking the banking deregulation that allowed insurance companies and commercial banks, investment banks, all to get together. And he said, what's going to happen to the data? And Markey, who was then a liberal member of the House, now a senator, and a conservative Senator Shelby, they put in legislation to say, if you're going to get everybody's data from their banking and their medical records and their insurance records, you should have to have their explicit permission, called opt-in, before you use it for other purpose. Before you sell it to third parties, before you use it for marketing, it should only be used for the purpose that it was collected the day they get permission. And there was momentum behind that. And instead, Bill Clinton and in alliance with the Republicans, they turned that down. And they said, well, no, because we'll have opt-out. You can always pull out. Well, opt-out doesn't do anything. That argument persists to this day. The question is, you're right, how is the data used? But if you said to Facebook, if you, right now, Apple is saying, because they actually make things like phones and so, they say, we have to protect privacy or people are going to be scared of these things. It caused Facebook to lose a serious amount of its market share at one point, right?
Because
they are totally dependent upon exploiting your privacy. So is Google and even Apple to a considerable degree, but at least they have a conflict about this. So the big issue from my mind after reading your book, which I think is really important, I thought, he's right. We have to have rules. We have to have regulation. The consumers have to know what's going on, and it has to be done in real English or real easy to understand and so forth. It's not going to happen because these companies are making so much money off this, and they lobby, and they scare us, and they tell us, the you know, you're going to lose your toys. Isn't that the reality?
There is a lot of self-serving rhetoric from corporations about privacy. Of course, there's a lot of self-serving rhetoric from corporations about anything that serves their interest. That's sort of the nature of the beast. I think this idea that we have to choose between privacy and innovation is one of the greatest myths that we face in trying to make our way forward and produce reasonable rules where consumers can be protected and companies can make money. I think we can have both. It's interesting that innovation is such a vague term that when you hear technology companies talk about innovation, if you replace the word innovation with the word magic, it doesn't ever change the meaning of the sentence. And when they use innovation, they use it to mean only good things. They don't use it to mean things like the hack of Target or of Sony Pictures, right? Those were pretty innovative hackers, but companies don't like to use innovation to describe clever bad things, just clever good things, I suppose. But what's most interesting is the way many marketing departments of companies talk out of both sides of their mouth at the same time when it comes to innovation. On the one hand, they say, well, innovation is just so magical and it can solve any problem. Remember the old App Store ads? There's an app for that, right? Any human problem, we can fix it with a little technological tweak, which we know is false. But on the other side, they, whenever regulation is threatened, they say, oh no, if you have regulation, it's going to stifle innovation. Well, I think that's just nonsense. There's an old proverb that necessity is the mother of invention. If innovation is so great, if our technology companies are so thoughtful and innovative and inventive, surely they can come up with inventions that make our lives better, but don't require us to sacrifice our privacy.
No, and but I think, it will require sacrificing the kinds of profits that are made now. Let's look at the reality. These companies came from nowhere, like Google and Facebook and so forth. They have been able to wipe out, say, newspapers. gone. Okay. Well, you know, yes. If you want to read a newspaper, you're probably getting it on Apple News or Google News or Facebook. Most of the ad money goes there. An astounding amount of ad money. The traditional journalism cannot be funded. So our whole information highway has been distorted and crashed, burned. And so these companies are of a breed we never had before, and the billionaires that follow from it. And when you look at it, they're not going to give that up, and they've got a lot of power. You know, your book is all about power. Well, they've got a lot of power to reach us with their messages and distort the whole debate. But then when you say, you know, they're good people there. Your book is full of examples. There are good people working there. But what could Google do if it stopped invading your privacy? That's what they sell. That's what Facebook sells. They'd have to go out of business. And so we have a monster here. We have this Frankenstein monster of a system now. That very powerful people with a lot of influence over legislators, with a lot of ability to influence the debate, can set the tone and affect even internationally. You're getting pushback from the European Union and others, as you describe in your book. But I don't see any way you're going to get these major profit machines that we've never seen anything like this before to suddenly turn it around. And that's what it would require. You know, and when you talk about how could you fund it otherwise, you'd have to pay. People don't want to do that now. They're spoiled. They want it for free, and they're willing to be manipulated. It's a really depressing situation.
Well, it is easy to be depressed. I've been in the privacy business for 20 years, and so absolutely there are some dark days. But you know, when I think about the future, I still have optimism, and maybe it's naive or Pollyannish. But the reason I have optimism is I grew up in the north of England, which was the first place in the world to industrialize. And the problems of the Industrial Revolution, mills, pollution, child labor, dangerous, unsafe working conditions, run by robber barons who were running these unprecedentedly wealthy corporations that had never been seen before, had lots of power. That was a daunting set of challenges, too. And slowly but surely, people realized that there was a better way than this innovative but destructive industrialization. There was a way to do things like having mass-produced clothes and mass-printed books without sacrificing children in the spinning looms of the mills in Manchester in England or Lowell in Massachusetts. But the key thing is this. Fixing or addressing the problems of the Industrial Revolution has taken us 100 years. And I'm under no illusions that the challenges of the information revolution that we're living through right now are every bit as thorny and every bit as challenging as the industrial age problems. But we didn't deal with the industrial age perfectly. but we dealt with it. And I am hopeful, or I guess I'd better find a different line of work. I'm hopeful that through our politics, through our media, and through cutting through some of the misconceptions about privacy, some of the myths around privacy, and pointing out why privacy matters, that slowly but surely we're going to be able to address many of the these problems we're talking about of the information age, the way we slowly but surely addressed many but not all of the problems of the industrial age.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest.
What is so powerful about your book is when you show us why privacy matters. And without privacy, you can't have freedom. That's why we have the Fourth Amendment, okay?
Absolutely.
Yeah, you cannot have freedom. You have to be alone to collect your thoughts. You have to, not everyone should know how far you read in a book or what book you read, you know? And they certainly shouldn't know what you said to your friends. And your book, Why Privacy Matters, makes that case as strong as I've read it anywhere, worth the price of the book. Unfortunately, it's not, you know, 1,000 pages. It's a 240, very well-written, good. So I would recommend this book. But I also think we should be alarmed, okay? Because if privacy matters, then what are you going to do about it? And what I would like to suggest to you, and I'm in a way got this from your book, maybe we've come to accept this. Maybe why we give up our privacy is maybe the ease of consumption. You know, can I use your location? Well, I was just looking for a restaurant. Yeah, I guess you can, you know, and you get all of this information pouring out. Maybe we are redefining ourselves, not as citizens of a democracy, not as alert human beings in a sophisticated culture growing all the time, but rather as shoppers, as I said before. The ease of consumption. And then when you have an emergency like a pandemic or terrorism, oh, here, take the last shred of privacy that I had. You know, here, take more, make me safer. And maybe you talk about dystopian images. You reject Orwell. You don't think that's sufficient. Why? Because it's too grim. Well, I would suggest maybe Huxley, and you have a few yeah, others, you know, drugs and so forth. But you really describe a population that I dare say is incapable of being free. If you have willingly given up your right to and this is not just to a private sector, but to governments everywhere, to know exactly how far you read in a book, Why Privacy Matters. I read this book last night. Now there are people around, because I read it in my Kindle version, there are people around who will know exactly what I wrote in comments, maybe what phone calls I made, what emails I sent out about it. They can present the most sophisticated profile of how and how to reach me in a campaign of ads and manipulation. And we're talking about, you know, in dystopian sense, the most ultimately malleable, distorted human experience where there is no individual authority or agency anymore. You are manipulated every hour of every day you're awake.
Well, that is the fear, and that's certainly the Cambridge Analytica scandal from 2016-17 created that risk, right? The idea that Facebook data could be used to create detailed psychological profiles to micro-target individual voters, either to get them to change their mind or to get them so frustrated with their candidate, in this case it was Hillary Clinton, that they just stayed home and didn't vote. And there's some evidence that some of that happened. I think the optimistic side is that the Federal Trade Commission did get involved. They drove Cambridge Analytica out of business. Facebook received the biggest fine in history. Maybe not enough. I think we have to be, as Oliver Wendell Holmes once put it, eternally vigilant against threats to our democracy. And I think
so. Let's be a little vigilant. You mentioned Facebook. Okay, Cambridge Analytics. Maybe they were the rogue people. But you have in your book the example of Facebook's contagion project, where they could change your moods. They could cater. Now, I mean, where do we get news from now? You know, you sign on. You got Apple News giving you their version of the New York Times. Or the San Francisco Chronicle. They're selecting the stories, or it's Google News, or it's Facebook's. And you know, even if we used to have, at least in the wilder days of the internet, you could start small publications and get an audience. But now, in the name of responsibility, and people say they should control it, no, they'll direct you away from those. They'll direct you to safer organizations. So we've even lost the sort of free spirit anarchy that we had in the internet. And really, I'm trying to get people to read your book. And there's nothing wrong with being alarmed if the situation warrants it. That's what's important about your book. You make the case. In fact, it's absurd that we even have to ask the question, why does privacy matter? For most people throughout human history, they knew privacy mattered. Even when they lived in a small rural village, you know, they knew it mattered. You know, you didn't put all your business out in the street, you know, or in the bar. We don't know that now because we've had a constant propaganda war that said, forget it. There is no such thing as privacy. If you're anonymous, you don't exist. You want to be out there. You want to reveal everything. And as you point out in your book, you give it away for free. You create videos. You show your family. You write stuff. You give it all out there. And then it's exploited by Google or Facebook. And so let me just, I mean, we're going to end this, but maybe your book should stress a bit more, and maybe we should stress a bit more, that these are not innocent participations, these corporations. They want it to come out a certain way, no matter what they tell you over dinner, no matter what they do in their advertising. Their profit model doesn't exist if they don't exploit your privacy, if they don't exploit it ruthlessly and shamefully. Now, with your analogy with the Industrial Revolution, that's why you had radical movements come, you know. That's why you had trade unions. That's why you had government regulation. That's why you had mixed economies, because you couldn't let the robber barons just set the whole culture. That's what we have now. We have the robber barons of Google and Facebook and their affiliates. They're setting the culture. And it doesn't matter. You can write the most persuasive book, but if they're setting the culture, they'll just twist it. They'll say, oh, yeah, Neil Richards, Oxford University, nice fellas. We're dealing with that problem. Yeah, we have an app for it. Here's an app that will handle that. Why privacy? It'll be very popular. You'll like it. Do these tweaks and you'll be safe. But you won't, right? Because that's what we mean by a business model. What is the way that Google or Facebook would make money now on this scale if they weren't treating you as the mark and exploiting your private data? How would they make money?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you can charge money for services, but in a market where free services or quote free in exchange for data, where apparently free services are available, even a mediocre quote free product is going to drive out a decent paid product. I think the solution is, and I talk about this in chapter 6 of the book, I think we need to rethink the whole notion of a free internet. Because I think these transactions aren't free. They rest upon at present, an often unrestricted or under-restricted data bargain, where that data is used to manipulate us. And so I think advertising has its place, but I think we've perhaps over-leveraged the importance of advertising, and it's having corrosive effects on our culture, not just the advertising, but the data trade, the manipulative, privacy-invading
targeted. It's not old-fashioned, as you point out. This is not Vance Packard and, you know, the 1960s Mad Men advertising. This is precise, targeted advertising based on knowing more about you than you know about yourself. And it's a lethal phenomena. I don't want to be the Luddite here, but the answer clearly has to be, going back to your industrial union, maybe you have to industrial revolution, maybe you have to break up Facebook and Google. That's what you did with Standard Oil. Maybe, you know, one thing is, for instance, to have a variety of search engines. Maybe the scale is so immense, their power is so great, it can't be challenged. Maybe they represent the ultimate threat to the democratic experience.
I think you're a law professor.
Is that possible?
Certainly. I think we've done we've done a good job in our culture explaining and teaching ourselves ways that governments can threaten freedom and human flourishing. We're not quite as good at talking about private power, because these aggregations of private power haven't existed until the present at the scale that they've existed. I think there's a few things we could do. Antitrust law is definitely one solution, and we should seriously consider breakup. The other thing I think we should consider doing is to require paid options, or maybe even forbid free advertiser supporting options without meaningful consent. Another option would be to allow them, and this perhaps is my favorite option, to require that technology platforms treat our data with a duty of loyalty. In other words, they can use it to tell us how to get to Shake Shack or to get to the movie theater on a mapping service. They can use it to recommend a movie on Netflix that we actually might like sincerely. They can use it to improve our product experience. They can use it to improve the functioning of the service for all their customers. What they can't do is to use it to manipulate us, to sell us to advertisers like chunks of meat in a butcher's case. They can't use it to targeted political advertising. They shouldn't be able to use it to otherwise expose us to data breaches or other forms of harm. In other words, those old signs that the customer is always right. We deserve assurances that this data, which can do pretty cool things, is being used to benefit us rather than a great data heist and a great power heist to benefit them instead of for us.
Okay. I thought we wouldn't go this long, but I'm sorry. I find it interesting if we could take 1 minute or 2 minutes more. The power of what Edward Snowden revealed, and he's now been marginalized, obviously, and they took away his passport, and then they blame him for ending up in Russia when he was trying to get somewhere else. He didn't have a passport. But the thing that was really frightening is if it was just in the private sector, maybe other companies would rise up and provide better models. After all, I forget what it is, Duck or whatever. There are some other search engines. But what usually happens when there are alternatives, Google or Facebook or Apple or somebody, they buy them all up. And we've have this incredible situation where we've lost the whole idea of a free market. There's no variety. There's no choice. But the thing that Snowden revealed is that it doesn't stay in just the market, that governments anywhere in the world can get all of this information. That was, to my mind, the PRISM project, the whole revelation of Snowden, which has not been taken as seriously as it was, is there is no division between the private and government sector. And you have a company like Palantir, which came out of the CIA. 3 years, CIA was their only customer. Peter Thiel was involved and so forth. And, now they're a big private company. They're still doing police department, preventive policing, and everything. And so I think we have to wake up to the fact that what you have is kind of this alliance of big government and big corporations. And finally, I want to end on one, somebody who, we've criticized Bill Clinton here, but Barack Obama came out, he said he was going to do something about this. I forget the name of that legislation.
The Privacy Bill of Rights.
The Privacy Bill of Rights. And according to your book, he failed miserably because Google and Facebook and these people got to him and they said, you're going to kill the goose here that lays the golden eggs. And the other side is, we contribute to your campaigns. You used our technology to get to be president, very effective at it. And it came to naught. And so you can write, and you did write a very good book telling us we should do something about it. But, you know, honestly, do you really think it's going to happen?
I do. I do. 5 years ago today, I was testifying in Dublin in a case against Facebook. And that case has morphed into a system whereby European law is so powerful in this space. And then American law, if American companies want access to European markets, if they want access to the markets of the world, given the power of European law and the model that the European General Data Protection Regulation has, we're going to have some kind of an accommodation. And I think that, if nothing else, might provide the hook by which companies, and you see the Facebooks and the Googles and the Microsofts and the Apples saying, please regulate us, because they need the regulation in order to have harmonization with the emerging global trade standard, which is a privacy protective one. So I realize there are a lot of challenges. My book is to make the case for the continued importance of privacy on the occasion of its supposed death. And I realize there are a lot of challenges, but I remain hopefully optimistic that we can rein in these technologies. We can produce a legal environment, but a human environment in which, on balance, our data is private and it's protected, and where it is used, it's used loyally to serve human values rather than corporate ones.
There you have it. Why Privacy Matters, Oxford University Press. Neil Richards, a very famous law expert on privacy, makes a compelling case of why you should be concerned. I'm being the negative one here. Lots of luck controlling it. But if we don't control it, we don't have democracy, I think is the subtext, because it's really about power and the power of the individual to protect their own turf. That's it for this edition of Sheer Intelligence. Christopher Ho at KCRW does a great job of getting these things posted. Joshua Sheer, our executive producer, gets us our great guests like today. Natasha Akimi writes the intro. Lucy Berbio does the transcription. And thanks to the JWK Foundation in memory of Gene Stein, a great journalist and writer in general, who helps us with this. See you next week with another edition of Sheer Intelligence. Ni le bien qu'on m'a fait, ni le mal, tout ça m'est bien égal. Non, rien de rien, non, je ne regrette rien, c'est payé. Allumer le feu, mes chagrins, mes plaisirs, je n'ai plus besoin d'eux. Balayer les amours avec leurs trémolos, balayer pour toujours.